This is an interview with Brian Robinson, professor of anthropology. Today is February 6th, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. So, to get us started, I'm wondering if you can tell me what attracted you to anthropology.
Oh, boy, I think I'm an archaeologist, and I think I decided I was going to be one at about the age 16, so it took me a while to go through graduate school, but it's just something I always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. from a quite young age. I had worked on archaeological sites at that time at my home in Manchester, New Hampshire, and kind of became hooked. Uh-huh. So when I went to undergraduate school at the University of New Hampshire, I already knew what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Amazingly, I've managed to keep in the business.
Yeah, that seems remarkable to me that at such a young age you knew that you wanted to do archaeology.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's narrow-minded or whether it's insightful, one or the other.
Sure.
But from the first day in undergraduate school, I went in to see the professor. That's what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
I worked in it for a long time, cultural resource management, CRM archaeology, mm-hmm. Before going back to graduate school. Uh-huh. So I stayed in the business, but it took me a little while to decide that I had to get a PhD in order to go on with it.
Uh-huh.
So I returned to graduate school in 1985 to Brown University.
Uh-huh.
And got my PhD through them.
For Brown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've worked most of my life in the Northeast. Actually, when I came here, I came here as a research associate working on a grant-funded project on Central Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 3 or 4 years here and was part of the Climate Change Institute at that time. That was 1997.
Uh-huh.
And then became a faculty member in 2004.
I see.
So I've done really a decade of work in Alaska, and then most of my then mostly research in the Northeast. So I've always been northern. I've always been, you know, subarctic, mm-hmm. Arctic, all topics that were of interest to the Climate Change Institute at the time too.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you earn your PhD? What year was that?
I got my PhD. I completed my PhD in 2001,
mm-hmm.
And again, while I was here, was one of those times when I finished classwork and went straight to work, and
uh-huh.
Took me a number of years to finish it. But it was a large research project. I was redoing collections from the Moorhead burial tradition, or the so-called red paint people here in uh-huh. Maine, and so this was my area of study, and I'm living in the middle of it, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
So I finished that several years after I came here, at the same time I was doing the Alaskan research.
Mm.
And
I'm wondering, who contacted you from what was then the Quaternary Institute?
My predecessor, Dave Sanger,
right.
we were both Northeastern archaeologists, so we had known each other from about 1980, something like that.
So we meet each other at a conference or something? Or
I think just being colleagues in a way, you know, although long before, I was doing archaeology and publishing in it long before I got my graduate degree. So we all kind of knew each other, yeah, certainly from conferences.
Uh-huh.
And
you had read each other's work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my PhD dissertation, David Sanger was on my, was the outside reader for my committee.
Mm-hmm.
So we had worked rather closely for a long time. And I had worked for him here in 1989 doing contract archaeology as well.
Mm-hmm.
So... because of the nature of my Alaskan research, I was fairly flexible as to where I could be,
mm-hmm.
And my wife and I chose this as the place to be,
I see.
And it ended up being very fortunate, and again, I got the Northeastern archaeologist position here after Dave Sanger retired. So Adrian Burke had been here for a couple years in that position, then he moved to Montreal, and then I.
And so Dave retired actually some time ago.
Yeah, he was. I can't tell you exactly when, but he went kind of a half-time position, overlapped with us, and that was great because in any institution, there's not too many of us that have the same specialization. So it's always just wonderful to have colleagues that you can commiserate with when you're doing research and otherwise. So he and I overlapped for a long period of time. He had the office across the hall from me, and we really had a lot in common in terms of our research and background over the past 20 years. So it really worked very well.
Can you discuss some of the research you were doing in Alaska?
Yeah, I was working with Fred West, who had done extensive excavations in central Alaska in the Tangle Lakes region, not too far from Denali National Park. And he had 150 sites, and a lot of them were, at the time he excavated, an unusual number of late Pleistocene, early Holocene sites, so about 10,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And I helped him. I conducted research on those sites for a number of years, went to Alaska, and in fact I've just been asked to finish the book on the research as a whole. So at that time, the basic identifiers of culture history and other, how do you even recognize what's a culture? Is there two cultures or is there one culture? These kinds of things were unanswered and are still unanswered, and but it has a lot to do with the seasonality, the movement of the people. You're in an Arctic environment, so that you have very extreme environments. How do people adapt to that? And in this case, my research has been that it seems that one of the explanations is that they had radically different toolkits in the winter and in the summer, partly because in the winter, in some areas in Alaska, you're basically in the dark 24 hours a day. Lithic sources are snow covered, so just getting access to material to make your hunting weapons with was difficult. So they had radically different technologies, and that made the archaeological record kind of confusing and we're still sorting that out. So it was really a great project, because a number of projects that I've had have been really large data sets from many sites. Mm-hmm. So it allowed me to do landscape analysis and activity patterning over big areas. And again, it's partly in this case because I worked on a series of sites that were the life's work of another researcher. Mm-hmm. And got to look at the technology and the spatial arrangement on the landscape. So it's been really good.
So did you find that where previous archaeologists thought there were two cultures, there in fact was only one, but the differences were because the tools were so very different.
That's exactly right. You picked up on that really quickly. It was basically two almost completely different sets of tools. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. normally we like to think that people have a culture that's fairly similar and that you could recognize them based on their different tools. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the proposal that is still not accepted, but now at least more popularly looked at in Alaska, was that with different seasonal toolkits, they were both different tools and in different places. Mm. So it was very tempting to look at this like, well, this must be different cultures. Mm-hmm. So when you see different groups of tools in different areas, different material types, I think it's pretty logical to assume that they were they were different people. And that's one of the things that archaeologists have been doing for the last few decades, are really realizing the diversity of activities mm-hmm. and conditions that people had to live in. Literally, in this case, the stone that would take, if you're making stone spearheads, it takes a pretty big piece of stone. And you can be, in Alaska, you can be at temperatures 40, 60 degrees below zero, where the stone would rather shatter than it would flake properly. Mm-hmm. Well, with the other technology that they used 10,000 years ago, and 16,000 years ago in Siberia, mm-hmm. was so efficient that you could practically have a pocket full of stone and get yourself through the whole winter. Mm-hmm. It was that's a thought, that this is one of the ways that people were actually able to move into the high latitudes and survive in these really extreme conditions. Mm-hmm. So, and again, it's still, the research is still going on. This idea of sharply contrasting activities, it's just the last decade, so almost the last 5 years in Alaska, that it's really picked up. Mm-hmm. And now everybody's asking more complicated questions about the archaeological record. It's really mm-hmm. it's really good, because everybody's point of view, everybody's testing different ideas, and that's what we need to do.
Right.
So it was fun being a part of that, and I'm working on writing up the research as a whole.
Sure. So that's sort of a project that's still ongoing for you.
Oh, it's still ongoing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially finishing the book on it. We had done quite a bit of it before I got my position, my full-time position here, mm-hmm. but now it's picked up again to try to get the work done.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I'm wondering if you can now shift gears to your research here in Maine.
Sure. Well, a couple things. That background was the working with large collections, doing spatial analysis. Mm-hmm. Working with northern climates was what I was doing when I came here. And early on, while I was here, I started working on a Paleo-Indian site in the Northeast. The site was actually in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Again, it was an old collection, old set of collections. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the excavators of the Bull Brook site in Ipswich, Massachusetts, had claimed that they had a large camp circle with 40 houses in a village that was 12,000 years old. And when they claimed this 50 years ago, nobody believed them. And then, because we thought it didn't fit our anthropological models, literally. Mm-hmm. We thought that at that time they must be small groups of people, mm-hmm. highly mobile. And then about 20 years later, the anthropologists and archaeologists going, you know, that was possible. And by that time, the site was already destroyed. Uh-huh. So I got to know these people, the excavators, uh-huh. and I worked with them for, again, while working with Fred West, this time in Salem, Massachusetts. I got to know them for, and the fact that more I got to know, they collected a lot of data because they thought they had this pattern. They actually collected data that some of the archaeologists at the time weren't interested in. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of fascinating. They became so dedicated to the idea that that this pattern couldn't be arbitrary, that big circular pattern had to be real, that I worked with them for quite a number of years and only slowly said, boy, we can redo the mapping even though the site's gone. So now with the help of Photoshop and digital technology, mm-hmm. we took their home movies and their photographs and digitized them and replotted the whole site and got GIS coordinates on the original excavations mm-hmm. of each of those. And we have made a pretty strong case that they were correct. And mm-hmm. it makes it the largest settlement largest single organized settlement in the Western Hemisphere during the entire of the Pleistocene.
Wow.
Without even really any close second. So it was really a spectacular site, and that led into again, why were they there? What were they doing in Massachusetts? And again, with people working here at the Climate Change Institute, working on sea level change and bottom bathymetries and things like that, my present hypothesis is that when you lower the sea level to what it would have been 12,000 years ago, which is when these people were living there, I was actually looking for some kind of a ravine that may have helped direct caribou or something like that mm-hmm. up off the coast. And there was no ravine. What there was Jeffrey's Ledge, which is a fishing ledge, but it turns out it would have been an island. So when the sea level was 150 feet, 50 meters lower than today, there was an island out there that was a third the size of Cape Cod, just offshore. Mm-hmm. And the present theory is that this island during the cold period, still during the glacier period, would have been a good place for caribou. And in the winter, caribou come off such islands, go into the woods, and that would put them right past this site. So it would be very predictable. The people could have gone down and looked at the island, saw how many caribou they were, mm-hmm. But they needed a lot of people in order to direct the caribou to where they wanted them to go, basically. Mm-hmm. So the suggestion is that it's a communal caribou hunting gathering, if you will. And it was on a piece of land that was not badly disturbed. And then these amateur archaeologists found it just before it was destroyed by sand pit operations. And they did a good enough job. Mm-hmm. And so that was I worked quite a number of years on that because it was literally having to reconstruct the mapping, figuring out where in the woods a photographer was standing when he took pictures, mm-hmm. and ended up using triangulation methods and methods that we could actually put the photographer in place where he was standing for each photograph 60 years ago. Wow. Which was pretty neat.
That is so really remarkable.
And I wouldn't have been able to do it without, I worked for most of it with the original excavators, especially a guy named Bill Eldridge, who really saved the site, and he was as sharp as a pin, and I interviewed him for 15 years over time and learned something every single time that I talked to him, right up to his 90th birthday. Uh-huh. We had a party for him when he turned 90, and he just wanted to get back down to the basement and keep researching. Mm-hmm. So that was really kind of a privilege in a way, and it ended up being a very unusual site. Mm-hmm. And work done with sea level rise here, the theory isn't proven yet, but it has a whole lot of elements that have to be just right. The timing has to be just right. The sea level has to be just right. Then eventually we could find samples, freshwater samples on this submerged island, and it could actually be proved. Hmm. So we start out with these models that are somewhat speculative or plausible, and they make something make sense, but then we still have to prove it. And in this case, there's so many variables that have to work, that have to come right tightly together, mm-hmm. that it makes a good case. Mm-hmm.
I was actually just about to ask you in what ways climate science has informed your research, but I see that...
Well, since I've worked in the Arctic and northern climates and also with Pleistocene materials, everything is climate change in terms of... trying to figure out where people were in the landscape. Mm-hmm. I had another thought, an interesting story as far as influence goes. I was here at the 25th anniversary mm-hmm. of the Climate Change Institute, and at that time, before that time, we had Hal Borns and George Jacobson and Dan Belknap, Joe Kelly, all those people working on paleoclimate and paleocurrents and marine change. And a lot of that work was done locally here, here in Maine. Mm-hmm. And then things branched out as time changed. And I was, in 1997, Paul Majewski gave, I guess, one of the first talks he had given here at University of Maine. And I was there, and I guess I had the privilege of not knowing what he had done before he talked. And sometimes it's kind of enjoyable just to discover something when somebody presents it. Mm-hmm. And I remember all the talks, and prior to the ice research, trying to get resolution in time, mm-hmm. in climate change was a lot like it was in archaeology. We had radiocarbon dating. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you could get plus or minus 50 years, and or with extenuating circumstances, do better than that. And then Paul gave the talk on the Greenland ice cores, and he had resolutions down to a year, 100,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and I had just never seen anything like it. And that really introduced the whole topic of abrupt climate change, things we weren't even thinking about before. Mm-hmm. And that's a real challenge for archaeology, because we still usually don't have that kind of resolution in time. And we're getting better, but we still have to have the right piece of charcoal and do multiple dates and things like that in order to get our errors down to something like 20 years, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's been a real challenge and a whole change in point of view in terms of the kinds of climate effects that affected people.
Mm-hmm. Have you had many opportunities to do research with other members of the Institute?
I think it's been mostly, I work a lot with Alice Kelly. Uh-huh. I worked with Joe and Dan and Marty Yates doing Marty's in the earth sciences. Mm-hmm. But one thing that as an archaeologist, another thing that comes with the Climate Change Institute in a way, and the geology department and the associated departments, is just a wonderful set of toys, if I may, that most archaeologists don't have an opportunity to work with. So the scanning electron microscopes, the microprobe, those kinds of things. There's a wealth of technical analyses in archaeology that have not yet been done. We find faunal remains, animal teeth, microscopic remains, all of those things can be looked at more closely, can be looked at for either chemistry or isotopes or seasonality or growth rings, all of which takes equipment and expertise and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I know in other, many other anthropology departments, very good anthropology departments simply don't have access to those kinds of equipment and that kind of expertise. Mm-hmm. So that's why the masters in the Climate Change Institute for archaeology here is so very good for those people who are focusing and maybe wanting to go on for their PhD mm-hmm. In climate-related studies in archaeology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you and Dave Sanger had done research together. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Dave... this brings up a number of topics. Dave did a lot of work when he came here in the 80s. Did a lot of work on the Shelmans. Mm-hmm. Shelmans are on the coast, places where basically kitchen middens, where people had dumped their refuse, and it included a lot of shell, clam shell, mostly, but sometimes oysters, sometimes quahogs. And that shell makes the soil less acidic, and you get excellent bone preservation. If in a shell midden, we'll get the fish bones down to the size of anchovies. I mean, the tiniest bones that you can imagine will be well preserved. If you go 2 feet beyond the edge of the shell midden, you get almost nothing. You get only small fragments of burned bone. Mm-hmm. which is what we usually have on the interior. So in this little narrow strip along the coast, you have spectacular bone preservation, which allows you to look at animal bones, tool technologies, things that you don't see otherwise. And right at the moment, jumping to the present, it's one of our great fears and problems is that we're losing all those sites. With projections and sea level rise, these things are on a very fragile strip of the coast, and a big storm can take a site out. Mm-hmm. So they're projecting rising sea levels and big storms. Well, there's thousands of those sites from the last 1,000, 2,000 years, and we're projecting that the vast majority of those may be gone in 50 to 100 years. Well, we're not doing nearly enough work now to even start to salvage those sites we're losing. When Dave was working in the 1980s, he got some grants. He did large-scale surveys of several of the intensive surveys of several entire bays, mm-hmm. and had quite a large number of graduate students working on those in things that right now I couldn't replicate the work that was done. So he did these large-scale surveys that people are going to be mining those for generations, and if in fact things go the way we think they are, we may lose the shell middens, then these are going to become an archive. So Dave did a lot of large-scale survey that now allows me to focus really closely on individual sites. In other words, my current work has been spending a number of years on a single site in order to better understand the activities that took place on it. Mm-hmm. And I guess in a way I feel a little bit better able to do that because all Dave's work is in the background of really important research on site distributions and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had that in common as well as a number of other things. Well, actually, Dave was one of the first people to write on microblades in the Northwest coast that ended up, some of my work in Alaska followed up on as well. So mm-hmm. we've worked on both sides of the continent and overlapped in areas of research.
Mm-hmm. Since you've been involved with the Quaternary Institute and now the Climate Change Institute, how has it changed?
Oh, I think I'm still a relative newcomer, but I at least, and one thing that's nice about what you're doing now is that the founders are mostly all still here. I work with Hal Bornes quite a bit because he's interested in Paleo-Indian studies. He's interested in Vikings, all kinds of things. Yeah. And he did the geology on some really major Paleo-Indian research in Nova Scotia back in the 60s. So we have, again, all these common interests, and that's been really great. And then I've worked and published with George Jacobson on, in this case, it was on salmon populations over time. And the problems of identifying them in the archaeological record and whether there was many salmon here or not, you know, this kind of things. That was a long interest of his because salmon are in a kind of critical, this is the southern end of their range. So changes in temperature and water temperature will mm-hmm. cause that range to shift.
Yeah.
So because of that, it bears on fisheries programs going on today.
Mm. I'm wondering, can you maybe walk me through your collaboration with George Jacobson? I mean, how did that come about? Were you at one of the Climate Change Institute's annual gatherings? And
I came here as a research associate. I wasn't a faculty member, but being a research associate in the Climate Change Institute includes you in everything that they do. So I've given what was it? Now the Borns Symposium, used to be the Agassiz Symposium, papers, in which you present your research. And this is, it's a pretty formidable group here with a lot of different backgrounds. In fact, I've told my students it's one of the more formidable groups that they'll ever give a paper, because usually you're talking to your own peers and people that are familiar with your work, which makes life a lot easier, you know.
Sure.
And in this case, I gave my research on Alaska and then on Bo Brook, and people like Hal and George and Dan Sandweiss and others were just always very supportive, going on field trips that again used to be a kind of a family affair, where the whole group would go out for several days and socialize and get to know each other and things like that. And I would say, you know, in a way, I was not primarily climate oriented when I came here. I've been doing regional culture history, and you get drawn into things that are new to you, and then that's when you find what an advantage it is. In a way, I've been drawn a couple of different ways. Certainly, the Climate Change Institute is a major influence. And now, as a Northeastern archaeologist, I do Native American archaeology. Mm-hmm. And another change in recent decades has been the degree to which the Native American communities involve themselves in archaeological research. You would think that would be that the Native Americans and archaeologists would have a lot in common, but a lot earlier on we were pretty separate, you know. Mm-hmm. And now it's really part of my job to work with the Native communities and find out what their interests are and how we can contribute to that. Mm-hmm. So I got pulled that way too, in very explicit ways. I'm now working with the Passamaquoddy on their petroglyph sites. Mm-hmm. And I probably wouldn't have taken that on, if you will, because petroglyphs are hard to interpret. It's a very, very different field, you know. But when they acquired the land, acquired the petroglyph sites, wanted to manage it, wanted to do the archaeology, mm-hmm. then I worked with them. So I got pulled towards the culture history of Northeastern natives from the interests of the communities themselves. I also got pulled towards a greater variety of climate research than I would have done at the same time, and the two can fit together just fine. Mm-hmm. In a way, I talked about the ice cores. The ice cores were a great challenge because they gave a resolution of climate change that, I wouldn't have even fathomed had I not seen it presented. Well, the challenge was then, well, how do we look at archaeology? How do we bring this into archaeology when we don't have the resolution of data? And, well, you look in more detail. And that's what I think some of the Native Tribal Historic Preservation officers were more interested in as well, looking in more detail at the cultures. How do they change more subtly? So they both are looking into the data in more detail, but bringing in a greater complexity of the kinds of things that influence culture. Mm. So those, I would say, I was doing large-scale landscape and settlement pattern research before I came here, but I would say I got with the Climate Change Institute and working with the Native communities here in Maine, I actually got pulled into more detailed, more precise research, if you will, that you need in order to confront questions from both of those points of view. Mm-hmm. And would I have done that otherwise? I don't know. It wasn't the direction I was necessarily going at the time, you know, mm-hmm. so that's been a good thing.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the gathering held by the Institute in which faculty briefly present their research It sounds like that's pretty useful in maybe giving an indication of which faculty do research that could be of use.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And you know, I'll give you a couple of points of view. It took me a while to appreciate. And when you start out with something, especially, you know, in my case, I hadn't even finished my PhD when I was here. Mm-hmm. I was quite frankly intimidated by the group of people. I mean, it's a pretty outstanding group. Again, that I wouldn't be talking in front of. And you're nervous about those kind of situations. I think maybe you don't see the benefit of it. Mm-hmm. But having done it for a number of years, and then especially now after becoming faculty and watching the graduate students go through it, mm-hmm. I just think it's almost a critical aspect of what you need to go through. You know, the students are mm-hmm. usually really nervous their first year, and then it's fun to watch when they successfully go through the programs and they've then got their niche in life, their discipline sufficiently mm-hmm. under control that you can really tell that their presentations have been integrated from all these points of view. And the challenge is to present to a very diverse audience who have lots of different reasons to question your research that you may have not have come up with. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just been really valuable. Mm-hmm. It's gotten more difficult. The place has grown. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we just started last year was having, they call it the icebreaker, that we all get together and you know, I thought 10-minute papers were short. Now we give 2-minute presentations. Mm-hmm. But in that 2 minutes, the students can figure out who you are and whether they overlap with your research. So I thought it was a really good change. Mm-hmm. The papers have always been good, but there's a limit to how many you can have. And as the Institute grew, they've had to, you know, adapt to what they could do. Mm-hmm. There's always been a problem with the symposium on, you know, when's a good time for everybody to take 2 days, and there's no good time. That was that. So we end up doing it right towards the end, almost into finals period, mm-hmm. and still not everybody can make it for the whole meeting. But I just think it's a really important part of for the students and the faculty.
Sure. You came right around the time when Paul Majewski came and they changed the name from the Quaternary Institute to the Climate Change Institute.
Yep.
What did you think about that?
Oh, I'm kind of basically a stick in the mud. But their reasoning was absolutely correct, I think, nowadays. Quaternary simply was a name that it didn't have a lot of name recognition, mm-hmm. and I must admit the simple things like being able to be found in a web search is now really important. So I think on the whole it was fine. Mm-hmm. In both cases, right from the beginning, anthropology has been included in the Quaternary studies, mm-hmm. Because there's always been the concern and primary interest in how did people react to all these different changes. Mm-hmm. And it's not automatic, it's not directly causal. Mm-hmm. So anthropology was a good fit with that, and is especially so now with now that rapid climate change is upon us. Mm-hmm. It's now almost more commonly recognized. I think in the past it was maybe as anthropologists we felt like we were, you know, making the case that culture was different than the hard sciences and that you had to consider how different groups would react. Now it's almost like now that's become almost common knowledge. It's so obvious that different groups here in the United States react differently, almost violently differently, to even the concept of whether climate change exists or not. and it's based on their different subcultures and things like that. So I think it's almost more taken for granted that when we continue to go into this period of climate change, that cultures around the world with different opportunities coming from different places are going to react differently. And so it's almost like we don't get to lecture that anymore. It's like everybody knows it. So, so we just have to look at the specifics.
Speaking of climate change, it seems to be the case that, at least within outside the scientific realm, the human role in climate change is still being hotly debated. And I'm wondering if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
I think that's almost part and parcel of anthropology and humans, and we're parts of different groups, and it's kind of remarkable the degree to which we construct our worlds, and then at the same time the degree to which we can ignore other worlds. And and I think the combination of politics and religion and culture change, and I mean, I grew up during the Vietnam War, and a time when things were tumultuous in terms of directions we should take based on free enterprise or moral decisions or all this kind of thing. And it hasn't gone downhill since then. It's just changed a lot, you know. So you've got a lot of controversy going on, and at this time, I think in a way, the challenge of climate change is so great that for some groups, I think in a way I'll say it from my point of view, it's easier not to believe that it happens, but I think it's also a kind of a challenge that for some groups, questioning the science becomes the almost logical approach for them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the story of how different our subcultures and different cultures react and are likely to react to threats, if you will, in the future. To stresses in the future, and the fact that we can react so differently now means that having to take into consideration all our different points of view is just as important now as it ever was. Mm-hmm. I think to a degree, the movie The Day After Tomorrow, it had a big impact on the public, because the public isn't reading about climate change much, but you put it into a movie, mm-hmm. and it gets to a different segment of the population. Well, that comes and it goes, and people change, and climate change as a concern is such a long-term thing, and we are used to thinking in short-term goals. Mm-hmm. So I think it's easy to get excited about it, then to let it wane, and then to get excited about it. But it's interesting that the climate folks always like to distinguish between weather and climate. But when things start changing, when rates of weather change, they overlap. And we look at what's going on this winter to see if we can make sense out of it in terms of climate change. And I think people are doing that more and more. And, as some would suggest, we're already in the midst of a period of rapid climate change now. But, every time we have a warm winter, somebody else can question that. Is it really climate change or not?
Right.
So I, of course, in the Climate Change Institute, I'm an easy believer, mm-hmm. We don't all have the advantage of the exposure to the science on a daily basis like we do here. But also, again, there are very different belief systems, not just about the climate, but economics and things like that are part of society.
Mm-hmm. What role should the Climate Change Institute play in getting out there and educating the public?
You know, I can sympathize as much with others. I guess I, in much of my career, I guess I've been in some ways, a little bit behind the scene. I like the research, you know, I really do. And we put a lot of effort into documenting, making sure that when we put forth theories or whatever, that the evidence is there, that somebody else can go through it and check it. And that's very different than going forth to the public. Mm-hmm. But more so now than ever, and as you will you would see in the climate change instances now, there's a great consciousness in having to put these things before the public, mm-hmm. and a lot of discussion. One of my graduate students, Sky Heller, is in the Iger program on abrupt climate change and culture, and it's a major part of the discussion, not just the science of climate change, but how people are going to react, how people can anticipate it, and what can we actually do. You know, some people hope that we can slow climate change down. Others say, well, we got to prepare for what's inevitable. There's lots of different approaches to it. But I think it's really, really part of the program now that that it's a very serious, the way that different ways that people react is very serious and very important, and we can't impose things on other countries. But need to at least do our best at making clear what's likely going to happen. I mean, in the discussions in the Iger conferences about whole nations that aren't very far above sea level, mm-hmm. and some of them are now buying land on the mainland. Mm-hmm. But is it a country then, or is it not? You know, there's a lot going on. So I think, I think maybe you need both people who are very good at putting that forth and people who are very good at doing the science. It would be nice if we could all do both. Mm-hmm. But I think at least it's very conscious that it needs to be done. And it's sort of seen as there's the controversies that you talk about are part of what makes you wonder whether you're doing it as well as you could, mm-hmm. you know. What else could be done to make it a proposition that we need to seriously consider? Mm-hmm. It's changed a lot in just the last few years, mm-hmm. but it keeps on fluctuating in terms of whether it's on people's minds or not.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, from an archaeologist's perspective, has been the Institute's greatest contribution to our understanding of climate?
Boy, I guess I would go from climate change itself to rapid climate change. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in archaeology, I do a lot of reading on early archaeology, and in the 1930s, before they had radiocarbon dating, mm-hmm. people were doing their darndest to figure out how old things were, and were people even here 10,000 years ago? And well, in a way, that got mastered 50 years ago, but the way that climate changed, and now with concepts of rapid climate change, it just makes it so much more inevitable that climate has a strong impact. When in kind of a definition of abrupt climate change is when you can start to see that change from year to year, or maybe the major change is experienced within a decade, so that within a lifetime, people have had to adapt to very new conditions. Mm-hmm. I think before we had this idea of kind of gradualness. I guess that's a common thing. It starts out thinking gradually, and even the end of the glacier, did it happen in such a way that your grandparents might tell you about a time when it was colder, but still they didn't really change their lifetime that rapidly. And now with the most recent, actually one of with Paul Majewski's most recent talks, where they're taking each year and subdividing it into hundreds of samples and starting to see individual storms 10,000 years ago and the frequency of those storms, then you realize that the beginning of the Younger Dryas period, this last cold period, mm-hmm. and its end occurred in times that would have been just radical in terms of the people's worldview. What's happening? If their resources change location or disappear, and they have to come up with some kind of a rationale for what's happened. I think it's just brought it home how important those kinds of instances were in the daily life of people. Mm-hmm. And of course now it's remarkable. Rapid climate change in the present is not a very new concept. It's just within the last couple of decades that we had that, really with the ice coring, that we had the tools to look at that. Mm-hmm. And boy, what a good thing we know about it. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just worrying about or assuming that these things will be gradual, mm-hmm. but that there's tipping points, that there's points of no return, mm-hmm. that we could go into a glacial period very rapidly if the ocean currents change, mm-hmm. Things like that. And people experienced those things in the past. Mm-hmm. And probably had fairly radical reactions to them. And now we can at least try to think of what those reactions might have been. I mean, I'll just give you an example. This period that I worked on, the Paleo-Indian period in Massachusetts, they made a projective point. It's commonly called a Clovis point. Well, there's the strange things about Clovis points. They occur from Nova Scotia to Alaska to Mexico to South America, all across the continent. And there's still a question. It used to be thought, and maybe still is in areas, that they were the first people here, and that's why the explanation is there. But now it's thought that might not be the case. There might have been people there before. I can't think of another spread of a technology that covers a continent for a specific period of time. How did that happen? What caused it? Again, if they were the first people here, people spread and they brought their tools with them. But if not, one of the thoughts is that it may have been when the Younger Dryas commenced again, that the sudden change, the change in resources, basically inspired people to look for solutions, if you will, and also changed belief systems into what they needed to do in order to hunt for animals. And so these kinds of explanations are something that we really didn't have in archaeology before, because we didn't have the tools to know it could happen. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all the questions I have, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't think to ask you about.
Well, I think, again, my current research includes all my past research, of course, in different stages, but I think for the foreseeable future for me, climate change has an immediate impact. It's not speculative. I'm a Northeastern archaeologist, and we're losing, I think we're going to lose a major part of the archaeological record. That's a major part of the heritage of the native people of Maine. And when that's gone, we're going to be severely restricted beyond what we can do now. Archaeologists have a hard enough time. Our discipline depends on very little bits and pieces of evidence compared to what actually was. Mm-hmm. So when we lose whole categories of that, it's a permanent loss. Mm-hmm. So I think right now in the state of Maine, oftentimes these shell middens fall through the cracks. They're covered in a way by easements and conservation laws, so that you're not supposed to disturb them. But that as a result, they don't get excavated because of those disturbances. The amount of work is pretty small. We're doing I do a field school that's funded with a MAPI grant through the university, mm-hmm. where we work with the native communities and work on the shellmans. And that project was meant to be kind of initiate a bigger project. And I hope that's still what it's going to do, because we need to do a lot more. And at the same time, it's part of that to work with the native communities. And it was interesting, I've seen lately, native communities have taken on a leadership role in a lot of environmental movements, especially in Canada, mm-hmm. But also here as well. So the more people that you have integrated into these kinds of concerns, the more likely you'll see a shift in attitudes, mm-hmm. and establishing priorities. Mm-hmm. So I guess for me, in a way, in addition to climate change, the interpretation of climate change, it just so happens that my discipline is sort of like the melting ice caps. The ice core people feel it's an emergency to because they're losing their record, and they are. And it's somewhat like that's what we feel like as well in archaeology.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Brian, for participating in this interview and sharing some of those wonderful stories.
Thank you.
I'll go ahead and stop the recording.